On Titan, the molecules that have been raining down like manna from heaven for the last 4 billion years might still be there, largely unaltered, deep frozen, awaiting the chemists from Earth. You are listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show, heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Professor Dave, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Centre for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. Our quote tonight was from Carl Sagan's Pale Blue Dot, A Vision of the Human Future in Space. Titan is the largest moon of Saturn, and it is even bigger than the planet Mercury. Titan is also the only moon in the solar system that has its own atmosphere. That thick atmosphere, as much as it tempts us with thoughts of liquid and life, has also concealed Titan's true nature from us, at least until we finally sent missions to go and visit and take a closer look. Those missions have revealed a strange, cold world where water is frozen and natural gas is liquid. But it is also a surprisingly familiar world, with its own versions of lakes and rivers, winds, rain, and storms. Exploring Titan is an exciting project, and one that we have only barely begun. To tell us a little bit about Titan, our guest today is Dr. Ralph Lorenz, who contributed to the Cassini and Huygens missions that have taught us so much about our strange, fascinating cousin in the solar system. Enjoy the interview by Raymond Francis.
So welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
But Dr. Lorenz, you work with the Cassini mission, do you?
Yes, I've worked on the Cassini project, which is a joint NASA-European-Italian endeavor. Actually, my entire scientific career started working as an engineer for the European Space Agency back in 1990 when we started planning and designing everything. I built some of the hardware. It was on the Huygens probe during my PhD research in the UK, and then I came to the US in 94 as a postdoc and started working, planning the radar observations that Cassini makes of Titan's surface. And so I was lucky enough to still be involved when the Huygens probe touched down on Titan's surface in 2005. And the instrument I built finally did its thing.
Which instrument was that?
It was a part of what's called the Surface Science Package. It was aimed to measure some of the properties of Titan's surface. And specifically, I built a thing called a penetrometer, a little sort of stick that pokes out of the bottom of the probe. And when it was rammed into the surface of Titan, records a force profile which told us about the mechanical properties of the surface, how hard and how granular it was. So I spent 3 years designing and building something and then waited 7 years and it worked for the 1/20th of a second that it was supposed to work. So that was very gratifying. But that, in a way, was just the beginning of the Cassini story of unveiling the magnificent world that Titan has turned out to be, because Cassini is still in orbit around Saturn and it flies by Titan every few weeks. And on many of those flybys, we take radar images which show us Titan's very diverse landscape, and in many ways it's a very Earth-like landscape.
But in many ways very different. What's that landscape like?
Well, you often get asked the question of, what's Titan like, or where on Earth is like Titan? And my retort has become, where on Earth is like the Earth? Because Titan is a round body, like most planets, it means the equator gets more sunlight than the poles do. Titan has seasons, very similar to Earth, but much longer, because Titan takes 30 years to go around the sun. But it leads to a very distinct gradient in landscape with latitude. What we find at Titan near the equator is some areas that are mountainous, but vast fields of sand dunes that cover something like 15% of the body surface, a much larger fraction than is covered on the Earth or Mars by sand dunes. And yet when you go to the poles, which are slightly cooler, it seems that the liquids on Titan have accumulated there. Now Titan, being so far from the sun, is much colder. And a lot of materials that are liquids on Earth's surface, like water, are frozen solid. They're very, very hard, behave like rocks do on the Earth. But similarly, gases on Earth, some gases, in particular methane and ethane, are liquids at Titan surface temperatures. So there are literally lakes and seas of what is liquefied natural gas on the Earth sitting on Titan. And these bodies of liquid have morphologies and processes that are identical, at least in appearance, to those we see on the Earth. Now, the processes occur at different rates. You know, there's evaporation from the sea surface. We think there may be ultimately generation of waves. There's a hydrological cycle wherein the methane evaporates from the surface, forms clouds, and rain falls down, makes river channels, and the Huygens probe revealed some of those river channels. We've seen more of them with radar, and the cycle begins again. So we're seeing the same sort of processes that are very familiar and very important to us here on Earth, but occurring at different rates with different materials. So Titan, in a way, is a laboratory for a lot of these kind of processes.
And all of this at very, very cold temperatures, on the order of minus 200 Celsius.
That's right. The near surface temperature on Titan is about 94 Kelvin, or minus 180 Celsius.
Yeah. Is it imagined or is it observed that we have rainfall and water flowing on the surface?
What we've seen are clouds that come and go, and these clouds are at the altitude that we'd expect methane to condense. Methane makes up a few percent of Titan's atmosphere. Most of it is nitrogen like ours. There's no oxygen in Titan's atmosphere, but a few percent of methane, just as there's a fraction of a percent of water vapor in the Earth's atmosphere. We have seen clouds come and go, and we have seen areas on Titan's surface that got darker than they were before the clouds were there, and then that darkening has progressively decayed away, and the surface is back to what it was before. So we've seen evidence of at least wetting of the surface, if not pooling of liquids, following what we think are rainfall events. We see river channels all over Titan. And in a way, that harks to the terrestrial analogues question of, you know, we see large desert areas on the Earth, and where I studied and worked for a number of years in Arizona is like this. It usually isn't raining. And in fact, the river channels usually don't have water in them. But, you know, morphologically, what you see in the landscape is a landscape that's dominated by erosion, by rainfall. So even though it's an occasional process, it's the most powerful process in shaping the landscape. And so I think there's an awful lot to be learned by looking at the analogies between hydrological processes on the Earth and Titan. And that's one of the joys of planetary science, actually, is going out into the field and looking at analogues for what we see with what must be admitted is relatively poor resolution. Cassini was built close to 20 years ago, and it's operating 10 times further from the Sun than is the Earth. We have to peer through Titan's thick atmosphere using infrared instruments or radar, and we do so from flybys that are 1,000 kilometers up. It's not like at Mars, where we have orbiters with big telescopes that are only 100 kilometers away. So we have much poorer spatial resolution with what we can see Titan with. So to help sharpen our understanding, we can exploit the analogs we see on Earth and other bodies.
Right. So the fluid that's carving these channels is liquid methane.
Correct.
And the channels are carved into a landscape made of what?
Well, we don't know for sure what the bulk material of Titan's surface is everywhere. The expectation had been, before we got there, that we would see an ice-dominated surface, dominated by water ice. And, you know, the satellites of the outer planets are dominated, by and large, by water ice. And we know that spectroscopically and by other means. The composition measurements at Titan are more challenging because the Titan's atmosphere isn't clear. It has this organic haze in it, which makes it harder to take surface spectra, which is the usual means of identifying surface materials. There are little windows in the spectrum where methane doesn't absorb the light and the haze isn't too scattering. And so those give us some clues. But those clues, surprisingly, suggest that at least the top veneer, the top few millimeters, and maybe in cases meters and hundreds of meters perhaps, are not water ice. And we think the predominant material must be organic. There's a process by which methane in the atmosphere is broken down by ultraviolet light, by sunlight, and the fragments of the methane molecules, the carbon and hydrogen, and occasionally some nitrogen, recombine in all kinds of ways. And they make ethane, which is also a liquid at Titan surface temperatures, and we think is what makes up most of the seas on Titan, and a whole host of solid compounds like benzene and acetylene, and literally hundreds of others. And a lot of that solid material is what we think forms the sand dunes. Sand is actually a geologic term for a particle size, not actually a composition.
Right. And yeah, here on Earth it's mostly silicates. But
it's mostly quartz, but some places you get carbonate sands and olivine sands in Hawaii and things like that. But
right.
But we think the dune-forming material on Titan is predominantly organic. There are just one or two places where there is the signature of water ice. And one of those is actually around an impact crater called Synlap. It's about 80 kilometers across, and it looks like the ejector blanket, the material that's been excavated by the impact event, is water rich. We also see that water ice signature in areas where it looks like river channels have eroded down. So the picture is somewhat consistent that there's water ice bedrock that's covered in most places by some kind of organic goop. But Titan certainly looks like a rather sedimentary world where stuff has been deposited and moved around, and so there's likely a rich geological record if we could look at layers in places.
That's fascinating. You can imagine doing what they do on Mars with the rovers and looking at outcrops that show layering from vast history.
Absolutely, and there are remote techniques like ground-penetrating radars that might be exploited in future missions. And one of the wonderful things about Titan is it's, in principle, a fairly easy place to explore. There's the two challenges are that it's very far away, so it takes 7 years or so to get there, and it's very cold. Cold is something we know in an engineering sense how to deal with fairly effectively. And in fact, although liquid ethane and methane sound exotic, they're shunted around the Earth's surface in large tankers of liquefied natural gas every day. We know how to pump this stuff. We know how to make seals against it. So, in principle, the technology to explore Titan is there. And because Titan has this thick atmosphere, it's very easy, much easier than at Mars, say, to deliver hardware to the planet's surface. I mean, it's not a planet, but it's more planet than many planets. So one can imagine rovers working on the surface of Titan, just as you can imagine landers, arms that dig like a Phoenix lander, for example. But you can also imagine airships and airplanes and hot air balloons and helicopters and hovercraft and boats and submarines.
Right, because there's a thick atmosphere and then there's surface liquid.
There's a thick atmosphere and the surface liquid. I mean, in terms of the power, you might need electrical or mechanical power to hover if you're a helicopter, say, or a ducted fan jetpack or whatever. Because of the low gravity and the thick atmosphere, you'd actually need 40 times less power to do that than you do on the Earth.
Oh.
So, all these little cute remote control quadcopters and stuff, you could imagine working very well at Titan. So far, the most attention has been directed towards hot air balloons, which would work very effectively in Titan's cold atmosphere, and the prospect of having a capsule that might float in one of Titan's sea and sail. Actually, it'll be pushed around by the wind and by ocean currents, and that's something that I spent a lot of time in the last couple of years working on.
Now, that opaque, obscuring atmosphere, is it opaque all the way through, or is there a layer below which you could easily see the ground?
The reason that the atmosphere is optically opaque, and it's not so opaque that you can't see through it, we can see the surface somewhat dimly with Cassini's cameras, mostly in the near-infrared, actually the same wavelength that your TV remote control uses, just about a 1 micron wavelength. Red light is about 0.7 microns, and some of that works its way through the atmosphere, and that's why Titan is not colder than it otherwise would be. Some sunlight gets down to the ground. It gets very scattered by the haze, so you don't see sharp shadows, these wavelengths. But there's certainly enough light to see by, I mean, a thousand times full moonlight on the Earth, for example. So it is, and the reason it's opaque seen from orbit is because you're looking through many tens of kilometers of air. Because Titan's gravity is low, the atmosphere is very distended vertically. So if you're standing on the surface, it's not perfectly clear. I mean, there is some haze there, but it's not as opaque as the sort of fuzzy orange pictures of Titan's disk might lead you to think.
And so some low-flying aircraft might be able to do surface observation.
Absolutely, and we know that for a fact because the Huygens probe took pictures with a side and down-looking camera as it descended by parachute back in 2005. And, you know, there's contrast in the images that let us see dunes off in the distance, maybe 20 kilometers away, and the famous, you know, river channels carved into the surface. So it's very straightforward to explore once you get there.
So I'm curious again about the rain, the methane rain that's falling. Is this a seasonal thing? Does it happen every day at noon, or how does that work?
Well, that's a great question. So the areas I've looked at are twofold. One, the sort of microphysical perspective of, you know, how does an individual drop work? And some of the interesting things there are the low gravity, the thick atmosphere, and the properties of methane as a liquid. To say these are known industrially. And when a raindrop falls, its size is limited actually by the balance of aerodynamic forces and surface tension that holds the drop together. And if you look at that balance, the typical maximum size of a raindrop on Earth is about 6 or 7 millimeters, and raindrops fall at 10 meters a second, you know, as you know how fast they fall, you can see them. On Titan, that balance lets drops get actually a little bit bigger, about a centimeter across.
Okay.
But they fall much more slowly, at about 1.5 meters a second. So a little bit like big snowflakes falling on Earth. So if you can imagine a rainstorm on Titan, you could stand with a coffee cup and maybe catch each drop individually and fill the cup up fairly quickly. Now, as for when it rains and how often it rains, every raindrop that falls, if you think about it in a thermodynamic sense, is liquid that has to be evaporated some other time to complete the cycle. And the thing that drives that cycle is sunlight. And being 10 times further from the sun than the Earth, there's 100 times less sunlight per unit area. And that thick haze scatters and absorbs a lot of that sun, so there's even less gets down to the surface, maybe a 10% of that. So you have 1,000 times less solar power driving this process. And that calculation says that there's, on average, about a meter per year on Earth of rainfall of water. You know, you divide the heat flux by the latent heat. If you do that calculation on Titan, you get about 1 centimeter per Earth year. Now, the Earth's atmosphere holds a centimeter or two of precipitable moisture. I mean, water vapor, if you collapsed it down in the whole atmosphere, collapsed it down to a layer on the surface, it would be about the same as 1 or 2 centimeters of liquid. Okay. So you divide one by the other. You divide 1 centimeter of liquid by the meter of rain that falls in a year, and you get, you know, a week or two between rainfall events, a few days.
As a general picture.
So, you know, you get storms and they kind of concentrate the moisture a little bit, and so you get, you know, a few tens of centimeters in big rainstorms on the Earth, and they happen, you know, weeks or months apart. Mm-hmm. Now, Titan has this thick atmosphere. The surface pressure is 1.5 times that on Earth. It's colder, so the density is actually, you know, 4 times, which is why it's so easy to fly in Titan's atmosphere. That atmosphere has a few percent of methane. If you add all that up, it's meters of liquid equivalent. Mm-hmm. But there's only a centimeter per Earth year of evaporation. So overall, you might get a lot of rain in an individual event, but there might be thousands of years, or certainly centuries, between such events. So in a way, it's like an extreme extrapolation of how the Earth's climate may evolve as the atmosphere gets warmer. Mm-hmm. Warmer atmospheres can hold more moisture, so you get bigger storms but longer droughts in between.
Right.
And Titan's kind of an extreme example of that. I like to say Titan is to the hydrological cycle what Venus is to the Earth's greenhouse effect. You know, it's same physics, but an example working in nature that's sort of far extrapolated from what we fortunately have on the Earth. There is an interesting point, which is that because Titan's equator is inclined to its orbit around the Sun, just as the Earth's, also by roughly the same amount, about 26 degrees, Titan has seasons. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that most of the rainfall occurs during summer, where you get essentially convective storms. We saw lots of clouds around Titan's south pole back in 2003, and the years around then, that was when the first big telescopes with adaptive optic systems were letting us see Titan in detail from the Earth. And there were many clouds around the south pole, and then in 2003, it was the middle of southern summer. And so the place on Titan where there's the strongest solar heating, and therefore the most convective activity, was the south pole. Now, Titan is going around the sun. The seasons are changing. We had spring equinox on Titan, northern spring equinox, in 2009. And so we're just moving into northern summer. And that's why the continuation of the Cassini mission is so exciting, because it's letting us see these seasonal changes. We've seen changes in the upper atmosphere occurring with a sort of bizarre polar vortex cloud in the south. And we're all expecting and eagerly awaiting big clouds to start puffing up over the northern hemisphere in the northern seas any day now. So far, they haven't happened. One of the interesting things about Titan is that the southern hemisphere has very few lakes and seas. There's one large lake about the size of Lake Ontario, and it's called Ontario Larkus, because we call them after lakes on the Earth. And Ontario Larkus in the south looks like it's shallow and is drying out. We've actually seen some hints of shoreline retreat suggesting it's drying out. The northern hemisphere has three large seas. One of them, Kraken Mare, is almost 1,000 kilometers across. Another, Ligia Mare, is about 400 kilometers across. So these are so big, they're not going to change seasonally. But the question is, why does the north have these big seas, and why does the south look like it's drying out? And there the answer is that the seasons aren't quite the same. Just like Earth and just like Mars, their orbits around the sun are slightly elliptical. And so southern summer, as it turns out, coincidentally, on all three bodies, southern summer is slightly shorter but more intense than the summer in the north.
Okay.
And the way that seems to work with the climate cycle on Titan is that means the rainy season on Titan is longer in the north than in the south. And that means that the liquids can accumulate there, and that's why we see greater extensive seas and literally hundreds of small lakes in the north. Now, that wouldn't have been the case 20 or 30,000 years ago, because the orientation of the orbit with respect to the pole changes. These are what we call the Kroll-Milankovitch cycles on the Earth, and are implicated in the onset of the ice ages, for example. And you see similar evidence of periodic climate change on Mars in the polar layered terrain, where there's been different episodes of ice-rich and dust-rich material accumulating, similarly because the orbits and the season cycle has changed over tens or hundreds of thousands of years. So you've got, again, a terrestrial-like process occurring in a very different environment. So there's a lot we can learn by studying Titan. Now, as we move into the northern summer, we're reminded that it's solar heating that also drives most of the winds near the surface. And one of the puzzles so far in the Cassini mission is that all the liquid surfaces we've seen so far have been literally flat as mill ponds. And in a low-gravity environment and with the viscosity of liquid methane and ethane, you would think it should be easy to make waves. And the atmosphere is thicker, that helps as well. But because Titan's so far from the sun, the winds are actually fairly gentle overall. And we think it needs winds of maybe 0.4, 0.7 meters a second, you know, a couple of miles an hour, to cause waves to form. But they haven't happened yet, as far as we can tell. The weather models we have for Titan, global circulation models that have been adapted from Earth models, you know, Titan's gravity, Titan's atmosphere put in, suggest that the winds should start picking up any day now. Some models say it should have happened a couple of years ago. Other models say maybe in a year or two. And you see the same issue when you know, watch the Weather Channel or something on the Earth, that different models have different predictions on where hurricanes are going to go, for example. And we're just sort of grappling with those same kind of issues at Titan. And just as you can have calm days during a windy season, there can be windy days during a calm season. So we have to take a number of observations before I think we have any statistically robust indication of the seasons changing. But we're all eagerly awaiting some Cassini encounters later this year, where we're going to be looking at the surface of the seas with near-infrared. The way that can detect waves is by looking at the way the sun glints off the surface of the sea. When the surface is very smooth, you get a near-perfect mirror, and the reflection of the sun is just kind of a small bright patch. Mm-hmm. But as wind stirs up the liquid surface, you get a sort of wider and fainter scattering pattern, and that's been seen as a very iconic image of Titan that shows the sun glint from one of these northern seas. Also, the radar properties of the sea surface are very sensitive to roughness. And so with radar methods, you can detect the presence of surface waves. And in fact, radar scatterometers are used widely to measure the sea surface state on Earth's oceans. So there's a lot of really neat parallels and a lot to look forward to in the coming months and years as Cassini goes on.
Certainly, and we can look forward to more from Cassini over the next years that remain in the mission.
That's right. The Cassini mission was actually designed to function for 4 years from its arrival in 2004 until 2008, but it's been a very carefully built and managed and operated spacecraft. It's overall doing very well. The mission was extended for a couple of years initially, and then when the spacecraft has been holding up well, scientific output of the instruments has been very strong, and we're still husbanding very carefully the small amount of fuel we have on board, but we think we can make that last until the northern summer solstice in 2017. NASA will subject the mission to periodic review every couple of years to make sure it's still worth, you know, paying to operate it. That's certainly going to happen for the next couple of years. Beyond that, there'll be another review. So that really offers us the prospect of seeing basically half a Titan year of seasons changing, which will really help us understand how Titan works as a planet. There's also a kind of grand finale planned for Cassini. It's one of these sort of regulatory things that you can't leave plutonium sitting around in space. We don't want it, for example, to be deposited on Titan or Enceladus, since these are both bodies which are of interest in terms of origins of life studies. And so there's going to be a phase of the Cassini mission at the end where we drop the orbit very, very close over top of Saturn's atmosphere, and we'll study Saturn in a very close manner, much as, and in fact at the same time as, the mission called Juno will do the same at Jupiter. So there's some great comparative planetology to come from that. And then Cassini will be nudged to enter Saturn's atmosphere, where it'll burn up and be lost forever. But, you know, for a mission that was launched in 1997, you know, at a 20-year run with all the magnificent things Cassini's been doing, it's been a huge privilege to have been involved in it from the beginning.
Yeah, and hard to call it anything but a success.
Absolutely.
Well, thanks for talking to us about it, and we can certainly look forward to new developments from Titan, Saturn, and the whole system.
My pleasure. If you're interested in following up on any of this stuff, there's a lot of great material on the web. JPL Cassini website has a lot of material. There's some stuff on my own website. I'm easy to Google. And I've written a couple of books about Titan, Titan Unveiled being the more recent one, so you can follow up there.
Great. Thanks.
You are listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So Dr. Lorenz has been working on Titan for quite a few years now, and it looks like he has covered just about every aspect of that body and its systems and its atmosphere.
Yeah, I particularly thought it was interesting or maybe painful when he said that he worked on the device for, what was it, 3 years, and then he waited for 7 years for it to be deployed, and then finally it deployed and was done its work in 1/20th of a second.
The penetrometer, yeah.
Yeah, that's awful.
It lasts for the
poor
duration
guy.
Of the landing.
Yeah, that's a lot of effort and a, mm-hmm. a huge weight. That's a really... That's a tough life when you think about it. Mm-hmm.
But the amount of information they will give about Titan surface is valuable. For a scientist's point of view, it's a very, very valuable information, even though it lasts only for a fraction, you know, of time.
Yeah, yeah. And it's better than the first project I worked on in space, which was canceled a week before I finished it.
The troubled life of a scientist.
Yeah.
But yes, obviously extremely valuable, right? One of the best things we can do on any planetary surface is dig a little bit.
Yes.
So probing below the lander is an extremely worthwhile mm-hmm. thing, especially since we were so curious about what the surface of Titan looked like, what it was made of, what mm-hmm. what the hardness was and everything.
Titan is a very special moon because none of the other moon has a known thick atmosphere that can support liquid, even though it might not be water, but it's liquefied methane.
Yeah, there's weather. There's not very many places in the solar system that have weather that we're used to.
Mars has too thin of atmosphere, and Venus has too thick. But mm-hmm. Venus is a planet, and Titan is just a moon. So,
mm-hmm. yeah, we talk a lot about Mars, right, as a place where we'd like to explore. But in a lot of ways, Titan is a better Earth analog. Mm-hmm. Like you could actually fly an airplane there, right? So there are a lot of things where it's an extremely valuable place for us, but extremely weird too. Obviously, it's an analog, but of a completely strange sort.
Yeah, the chemistry is strange, but all the physics and the like geological and atmospheric processes are very similar. It's just a question of how do things behave differently at 90 Kelvin and when it's, you know, methane or whatever is the working fluid instead of something else.
Yeah. And particularly interesting since so much of that chemistry is organic chemistry.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So this, I mean, as he mentioned, it's not exactly silicate sand, it's organic material, sand. I mean, that's very exciting.
Yeah.
I think the big problem with the idea of finding life on Titan is there's just not a lot of energy, right? So, but nonetheless, there's plenty of material to build that life out of.
Well, and there's enough energy to drive storms and a whole weather system. There's some energy.
Yeah, that's over very long timescales, right?
Yep.
That's what he said. So whether it could actually drive or allow living creatures to have lives, that's tough. So it could just be microbes or something, but I mean, even that.
Yeah.
Titan, definitely a very interesting place for that reason.
Yeah, and you try to imagine how you can adapt our understanding of how planets work to strange environments, you know, different chemistry, same physics, right? All these exoplanets we're finding, there's hundreds of them now, and they all have these exotic compositions and sizes and temperatures, and so many of them are so very different from what we see, but Titan is nearby, and it's strange, but not as strange as those things. Maybe this is our first step to seeing things in funhouse mirrors.
And if there is some sort of funhouse life that exists there, then it opens up a whole different habitable zone, right? Because the normal habitable zone that we talk about is for liquid water.
Yeah, 300 Kelvin.
So if there's a methane habitable zone, then the exoplanet studies become, well, twice as interesting, right? There are twice as many opportunities.
Yeah, and there should be water on Titan as well. It should all be solid, probably.
Yeah, there's supposed to be a great deal of subsurface water as well, right? Because
yeah.
It did form in the outer solar system, and so it was made largely of ice, mm-hmm. in a way that terrestrial worlds weren't.
But, you know, I don't know what kind of conditions might allow that to be transiently liquid or to be available to life in a way that makes sense. We really don't know much of anything. You know, Dr. Loren's penetrometer has literally just scratched the surface of this planet, and that's all we've got, aside from radar observations and infrared pictures through the atmosphere. There's a lot yet to know.
Yeah, of course, a lot of the moons have subsurface oceans, right? Like Europa,
mm-hmm.
and Enceladus. So it's quite interesting to think that Titan might be having this whole variety of methane weather and lakes and perhaps methane-based life,
mm-hmm.
On the surface, but then below that could again be subsurface oceans. I mean, do we know?
I think one of the models has a liquid water layer between two different solid water layers. But if that's, you know, if that liquid water layer interacts in some way with the silicate, like, mineral layer, well, maybe you've got a salty ocean under there. Who knows? And maybe there's some heat source. Maybe there's some energy source. Maybe there's some materials. It's very speculative.
Yeah.
Together with the organic material that's widely available on the surface,
mm-hmm.
you know, life could be a possibility subsurface.
Yeah. It's bizarre at every layer.
Yeah.
But it's interesting at every layer, too.
I like his suggestion that this is a world that is, in principle, easy to explore.
Yeah, that was really... Yeah. Really interesting.
You know, aircraft and boats and it's got a solid surface and, yeah.
Yeah, submarines and balloons and basically every single variety of transportation or exploration on Earth would be just as valid and just as interesting on Titan.
And it's require less energy because the gravity is lower.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was good. Of course, there's less energy available, as he also mentioned, because there's less sunlight. But then again, Curiosity runs on a nuclear reactor, so...
Yeah. Yeah, there are ways of doing that. There's also lots and lots of...
Yeah. Yeah, lots of fuel.
The thing is that on Earth, we use hydrocarbons. We mine them as fuel, and then
mm-hmm.
we have a good technology that uses them. So to engineer something that works on Titan wouldn't be hard because we already have the technology.
Yeah. Yeah, we understand a lot of the chemistry that's there.
And like he mentioned that to seal it up against... It's like somebody talk about something about gas tank.
Yeah.
Like the CO they use for liquefied methane,
mm-hmm.
that can also be used in Titan.
Right, yeah. We already understand the environment there. We know how to handle liquid hydrocarbons that...
On Earth.
Yeah.
But just how cool would it be to have just a fleet of things there, you know, little quadcopters flying around, boats, little submarines probing.
I'd love to be the guy operating the Titan aircraft.
Who wouldn't?
Yeah.
Just take a turn at the controls, try not to crash it.
Yeah, you know, we talk about all of this using the hydrocarbons. We may have to provide an oxidizer, but that can't be too hard. One of the things that we talk about methane all the time on Titan, but the atmosphere is actually mostly made of nitrogen. The methane is the sort of the stuff that makes the weather and the clouds and there's some haze and things. There's a lot of nitrogen there, which is
again,
a very familiar kind of atmosphere, And, you know, nitrogen is very tightly bonded. You need something to break it down. But if you do break it down, you get to use it for making amino acids and things. Proteins that like to use that. So who knows what possibilities there are for that atmosphere.
Yeah, very interesting chemistry. And and a place where obviously we explore in any number of ways, and they'd all be really awesome.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Parshadi Patel and Michael Forrester, and featured an interview by co-host Raymond Francis. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Raymond Francis, Zangi Hu, and Dave Kirsch. Our editors were Zangi Hu, Parshadi Patel, and Michael Forrester, and I am Dave Kirsch. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes, or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, www.cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are www.facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can join us again next week, right here on astronomy.fm.